Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. Hey folks, I had the opportunity today to interview Dr. Janice Brainy, PhD. It was a fabulous interview and a great experience getting to know her. She was kind enough to speak to me about her research that she has done on microplastics. Look, Dr. Brainy is one of the first researchers to really discover, maybe I shouldn't even say one of, she is the first researcher to discover the prevalence of microplastics in the atmosphere, in rainwater, in dust. And so she talked to me about that research and that experience. I've got here pulled open her list of accomplishments and where she got her degrees at Utah State University. This is on her expert profile. So you can see here in her bio, it says Dr. Janice Brainy is an associate professor at Utah State University's Watershed Sciences Department. She received her doctorate degree from the University of Colorado Boulder in environmental biochemistry, biogeochemistry. She holds a master's degree in earth science and a bachelor's degree in environmental science, both from Simon Fraser University, Burnaby, Canada. Her research sits at the nexus of several critical zone disciplines and includes three primary themes: the atmosphere as a vector for material transport to aquatic ecosystems, climate change effects in mountain environments, and the cause, effect, and mitigation of water quality impairment. So please enjoy this interview that I did with Dr. Brainy. I will also include here her personal website if you would like to ever do a little bit more research into her and her work. Dr. Brainy, thank you so much for joining me today. It is an honor to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I came across your sort of journey into microplastics as I was doing a bit of research on my own. And I'm so glad that you said yes to be here, because the journey that you've been on and the research that you've done is absolutely fascinating. I wanted to start off by just maybe asking you, when it comes to microplastics, like, how did that start for you? How did you get into this kind of field of study?
Yeah, it was kind of an accident, actually. When I was a PhD student, I came to realize that we didn't fully understand what was in the atmosphere. The way we tend to monitor atmospheric aerosols is based on what's regulated. So we measure particles that are smaller than 10 microns, okay, or smaller than 2.5 microns. 10 microns is roughly the size of a red blood cell. And the reason we monitor these size ranges is because they have really important health implications, and they're regulated by federal and state laws. So that's what's routinely monitored around the country. But what matters for ecosystems is everything that gets deposited into an environment. And the bulk of what's in the atmosphere when we have a dust storm event is much, much larger than 10 microns. So what I wanted to understand was, what is this material? How much of it is moving through the atmosphere? And what are the implications for ecosystems? So the first thing I did as a faculty member was set up a network across the Western United States in collaboration with the National Atmospheric Deposition Program to add dry monitoring to their network. So it was great for me because I could capitalize on a network that already existed, but I needed to develop a mechanism for sampling. I needed to test that mechanism, demonstrate that it worked, and then they allowed me to collaborate with their network. So I set it up so that I could monitor particle deposition in rain weekly and dry deposition monthly, initially at just 12 sites across the West. Eventually that expanded to about 30. And when I, you know, first got the samples, I was really excited to see, you know, what is dust? What's in this material? And I saw a lot of things that you would expect, you know, pollen, minerals, bits of plant matter, bits of insects. and lots of things I didn't expect, including lots of pieces of plastic and lots of pieces of tire wear. And so that was back in 2017, and I hadn't seen anything published yet about microplastics in the atmosphere. So I realized this was probably a really big finding. And so I then spent all of my time and effort on trying to understand what was happening. And I didn't have funding or a graduate student. So all of this was done on my own time, evenings and weekends, and counting and processing sampling samples. And yeah, I was just completely shocked at every step of the way. I was surprised to see as much plastic as I did in my initial samples. And as I started to count and measure and quantify, it just, I couldn't believe it.
Which, by the way, you did a ton of work. If I recall, I mean, it was in the tens of thousands of plastics that you found.
So yeah.
Tell me a bit about the amount of plastics you were finding and the work that you had to do to get there.
Yeah, so the program is still ongoing, our deposition program, but I counted plastic for the first 14 months of the study in both the weekly wet samples and the monthly dry samples for all 12 sites. So that amounted to a very large amount of data, which was really great because we weren't able to just say, oh, look, there's this new pollution source or plastic is in this new environment or new media. But we were able to do a lot with the data to actually understand where that plastic is coming from and how it's moving through the atmosphere. So that made it more useful, the setup of the study.
And can I just say how interesting it is that this was in 2017 when this first began. And I mean, that's 8 years ago. Plastics have been around for decades and decades. And the fact that it wasn't really understood or realized that we had these microplastics in the atmosphere, in the environment, in our dust, in everything really, and for it to take so long for that to take shape. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for a long time, most people thought that the problem with plastic was pollution and mismanaged waste and how it, you know, moved from the terrestrial environment into our oceans and was polluting our ocean environment. I don't think, you know, people weren't looking at atmospheric samples under a microscope, and they weren't looking at the full spectrum of what's in the atmosphere. So in that way, it was easy to miss until someone came along and did that. And I guess it was just hard to imagine that we had polluted the Earth to such an extent that a material cycle of plastic had developed. Once we did realize that, I think that's opened up a lot of avenues for research and interest in the scope of microplastic pollution and its effects on ecosystems and human health.
Which is great. It's great to know, because I mentioned this to you before we started recording, that I, watching a video on the research that you did and kind of what that took and all the time you put into it, I thought there's no way that she could do all of this on her own. She needs an army of people behind her, helping her to really get us all of the data that we need to truly understand not only what the situation is, but what the implications are for the future. And I kind of wanted to touch on that with you. This may not be your area of expertise, but as far as you understand, we have all these microplastics. What does it mean for the environment that we have introduced as much as we have?
Yeah. We're really only starting to learn what that means, and it's difficult to say exactly what the implications are, because plastic isn't one thing. It's many different types of polymers with many different types of additives. So not only do we have the effect of the polymer type, we have the effect of the shape or the form that it's in. Is it a fiber? Is it a bead? Is it a film? All of these different shapes and structures are going to have a different impact in the physical environment. And then in addition, all of the different additives that can leach out in the environment are going to have an effect. So there's a lot of research happening to try to understand what the implications are. And a lot of it's based on correlation. So we see, you know, decreased plant yield with more plastics in soil. But we don't necessarily understand what the mechanism is. So why is that happening? We see lower concentrations of bioavailable nutrients, different microbial communities. in general, it's rarely, the studies that are coming out rarely show that plastic is innocuous. It tends to have some negative impact in the environment. So across all sizes of organisms, they accidentally consume plastic thinking it's food. And so that can lead to mechanical issues. So it can block intestinal tracts. It can make an organism feel full when it's not, because it's not food. It can, you know, leach toxins into the organism. So in general, when organisms start eating plastic, they don't do well. We've seen shifts in infiltration of water into soils, changes in bulk density, microbial communities, nutrient turnover, plant growth, plant height. In terrestrial environments, we've seen similar disruptions in aquatic ecosystems. And then in the atmosphere, it can have implications like acting as cloud condensation nuclei. Mm. It can affect the radiation balance. And there hasn't been a ton of work yet to understand exactly how. And again, it depends on, you know, the color of the plastic, whether or not it's absorbing or scattering radiation. The age of the plastic will dictate whether or not it's hydrophobic or hydrophilic. So that's going to influence how it acts as cloud condensation nuclei. So there's a lot of potential implications, and it's, you know, is going to take an army of research to try to understand and disentangle all of these different effects.
Do you feel like the necessary resources are in place for the research required right now, or is there a long ways to go?
I think there's a long way to go, but there's a lot of people examining the implications. But what I struggle with a lot with my research is that I tend to, you know, highlight the problems that we've created in the world, but not necessarily offer solutions other than, well, we need to stop this, but how do we stop this? And one of the challenges with microplastics is that it's not like other types of pollution that we've dealt with in the past. So, for example, the effect of CFCs on the ozone, or the effect of emissions, acid precursor emissions on acid rain. We could turn off those tap and then prevent those negative effects from happening.
Within just a number of years, it would reverse the effects.
Because plastics don't break down into the base elements of carbon and oxygen, hydrogen very readily. Instead, they just fragment smaller and smaller. The life cycle of plastics is so long that we can't really turn off that tap anymore. We've polluted the earth to the extent that these microplastics are going to cycle through our earth system repeatedly. And so even if we stopped using all plastics and throwing out all plastics today, if we could magically make all our products disappear, we still have everything we've put into the environment for the last 100 odd years that's going to continue to circle around. So it's a problem of an enormous scale that just is going to require every level of governmental organization and every individual to tackle.
Yeah, it's interesting because when we did our last episode on microplastics, we did kind of a surface level introduction to the idea of it. And one of the things we found was that it was projected that plastic production was going to increase by at least double through like 2040. And this was in 2020 when we did that episode. And so, you know, in the number of just a couple of decades, that amount is supposed to double again. Do we know, I'm curious, how fast do plastics break down into microplastics? I know you have the primary sources of plastics, which is what it was meant to be. A cosmetic bead, for example, is a primary source. But then you have all of the jillions of different types of plastics that we have that break down slowly, and pieces of that flake off and make their way into the atmosphere. So for all the plastic that we are producing now, or that we've been producing for the last 20 years, or that we will produce in the future, how long does it take for those to become microplastics that are polluting our environment?
Yeah, so again, it depends on the type of microplastic. Different plastics have different tolerances to UV radiation, for example. So UV radiation can very readily break down plastics or make it brittle, so it fragments a lot easier. Although there's some UV tolerant plastics. So there's, you know, it depends on the polymer type and the additives. But yeah, it can happen quite fast. And you mentioned cosmetic beads, but there's other types of primary microplastics out there. So there's a lot of very tiny microbeads produced for the paint industry, for scientific applications. There's also, I believe, 3D printing plastic is powderized. And there's also, you know, a variety of other plastics made in very small sizes. So it's not just the cosmetics industry. I just wanted to make sure that was.
Thank you for pointing that out.
So right now the exponential increase in production is about 4% every year. So, you know, half of all the plastics on the surface of the earth, which is now, you know, greater than the mass of all terrestrial animals, we produced in the last 15 years. And a quarter of that since COVID. So since your first podcast, we've produced a quarter of what's on the surface of the earth. And we will do that again in the next 2 years, you know. So, you know, exponential increase is hard to imagine, but it also quickly gets away from you.
Totally.
Yeah.
So I'll just say this. Myself and my audience are not very optimistic when it comes to humanity's response to these types of crises. And, you know, this is one that is, it's very important. And it's one that is, while on one side of things, it feels like it is being talked about much more, it is not being talked about enough. And I don't see any real inclination, you know, for humanity to say, well, let's hold on a second. Let's maybe look at plastics and reevaluate what we're doing here. It is continuing to increase and it doesn't seem to slow down. Do you see any hope for any sort of legislation or any change coming down the line?
Well, I think in general, I'm not super optimistic, but with plastics, the opportunities for bottom-up or grassroots efforts is much greater than with some of our other, you know, environmental problems. And I think that's because plastic is so tangible. When we see images of plastic in our atmosphere or in organisms and places that it shouldn't be, it really triggers an emotional reaction, and you can immediately see in your own environment how much plastic you're using and make conscious efforts to reduce the use of single-use plastics. So roughly 40% of the plastics produced in any given year are single-use, which, of course, that's a ridiculous use of something that's going to stay on the planet forever, right? So people can start making that individual choice. Although I want to be clear that I don't think our plastic problem is related to, you know, consumer responsibility so much. We don't have a choice when we go to the grocery store to purchase products that aren't wrapped in plastic. We don't have much choice when it comes to clothing, and that we can buy clothing that are all natural fibers. You know, a lot of these, you know, wool products, for example, they're very niche and they're very expensive. So it's not available to the general consumer. So I don't like to make people feel personally responsible or to blame any individual consumer for the problem, because really it's about the production and the creation of new markets for plastics that are not necessary. It's the waste trade. It's the producers of a lot of these products that are for single use that are, you know, intended to be. There should be some producer responsibility, I guess, in what's being produced, and not so much the consumer responsibility. We don't have a choice. The producers have a choice.
Yeah. This is the same thing, not just with microplastics, but all of our consumption, right? Society runs, capitalism decides what's the cheapest, what's going to sell the most, and we basically just have to play the game if we want to survive and get by. And so I'm the same way. I don't prescribe to my audience that, you know, if you use plastic that you're a bad person, because you don't get a choice. You need to wear clothes and you need to eat food. And while there are some choices that we have, we're quite limited as far as the overall impact that it will have on the issue as a whole. I wanted to ask, in regards to the research, obviously with our current administration, are you noticing, is there threats to the research, to the funding for that research? Where's your head at there?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. It, you know, with funding being pulled out of our granting agencies, you know, massive layoffs. I mean, we can't do work unless we can get federal funding to do work. we have similar problems at the state level. It's really, it's hard to say, at least in the United States, how difficult doing research like this might become. But of course, this is not the only country in the world. There's lots of great scientists doing really important microplastic research in other countries.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a very important point to make. While in the US, we have a leader who is currently sort of, you know, removing us from the climate accords and removing climate conversations from federal websites and all those types of things, which is absolutely heinous. And it has an effect on you and your work and on researchers across the U.S. Hopefully, it's picked up enough steam and momentum now that the work can continue all over the world and that research and funding for those researches can come from other aspects, not just the U.S. federal government. So tell me a little bit about the research that you've done since your first paper in 2020. Kind of what is the state of the research and what are you hoping to accomplish in the next several years?
Yeah, so that first paper sort of outlined the, first of all, gave us numbers on the rate of plastic deposition in really remote locations. So some of our sites were, you know, 300 kilometers from any major urban center. So truly, really remote.
Yeah.
And because of the amount of data we had, I was able to use back trajectory atmospheric models to try to understand where that plastic was coming from and how much time it was spending in the atmosphere. So I was able to show that plastic that falls out in rain tends to come from more proximal sources and urban centers. But most of the plastic was falling out under dry conditions, and that was coming from really far away, so potentially cross-continental. But with this data that we collected, I've been able to collaborate with atmospheric modelers to answer more specific questions about how plastics are getting into the atmosphere, where they're getting into the atmosphere. So with Dr. Natalie Mahawald at Cornell, she's an atmospheric modeler, we use the data to test five different hypotheses or five different potential mechanisms for microplastic emission to the atmosphere. And with pieces of material in the microplastic range, so anything larger than a micron, that needs some sort of physical mechanism to move it into the atmosphere, some sort of force like wind or friction. And so our hypotheses were that cities might be a major source. Roads, so cars traveling on roads produce a lot of friction. That might be a potential source. The marine environment with waves, wave action, and breaking, emitting aerosols into the atmosphere. Major dust-producing regions that also had people there was a potential source, and then agriculture is a potential source. So ag soils tend to have more microplastics in them than wildland soils because a lot of plastic mulch is used, and also because, at least in the U.S. and in some other places, a lot of the biosolids that are produced in wastewater treatment plants are turned into fertilizer and then applied over the landscape. So wastewater treatment plants are really, really effective at removing plastics from the wastewater stream. So they're not getting into our marine environment, but they are collected into that solid fraction that we then readily apply across the landscape.
Reintroduce it right back in.
Yeah. So in drier areas, like here in the West, ag activities tend to produce a lot of dust, especially, you know, not just when, you know, tilling or other physical activities are producing dust. In the last few years, the last decade, we've been in a major drought. But in the last few years, some farmers have been paid to keep their fields fallow to avoid using water. And so that can lead to wind erosion of that soil as well. So we used this model to use the real-time deposition data, use the atmospheric movements at that time to test how these five different potential sources matched our data. And we were able to determine that globally, the marine environment was the most important source to the atmosphere. So lots of plastics coming off of the marine environment and from the marine environment onto land. In the terrestrial environment, roads were the most important. Ag was the next most important. Cities were not that important, probably because of the effect of roads. in the model coming out is more important, but also because we think because buildings disrupt airflow. And so it's in a city environment, it's difficult for the air to actually, the wind to reach the ground to pick up plastics. So cities ended up not being important at all, but the main players were the ocean, roads, and ag globally. We've also been trying to understand, in terms of the atmospheric component, the potential impact on the radiation balance. So does it impact snowmelt timing? Mm-hmm. We haven't published this work, but I've been working with Dr. Mackenzie Skiles at the University of Utah on that question. Yes, it does influence snowmelt.
Good. I was going to ask if we could get a sneak peek answer on that one.
Yeah. And we've been trying to understand how nanoplastics get into the atmosphere as well. So as I mentioned, microplastics need a physical mechanism, but nanoplastics, because they're so small, they have very high electrostatic attraction. So it's actually very hard to erode that size range off the surface of the Earth. Hmm. So generally, aerosols in that size range need to be emitted directly to the atmosphere or are created in the atmosphere. Oh. So some, emission source. So we think that's potentially incomplete combustion and during incineration could be a source of nanoplastics to the atmosphere, or the breakdown of microplastics in the atmosphere from UV radiation into nanoplastics. So I've been doing a study in Ireland to try to address that.
I'll ask about that in just a second. On the nanoplastics piece, are there primary nanoplastics or are they pretty much all secondary?
Yeah, I don't think... that's a good question. You can buy nanoplastic standards, which means they are being produced. Whether or not there's a mechanism that would release them into the environment, I don't think so. Not sure.
And the prevalence of nanoplastics versus microplastics, is it comparable? Is there much more microplastics than nanoplastics? And then also on that note, do you think that nanoplastics pose more of a threat to the ecosystem than microplastics or vice versa?
Yeah, so we're really at the edge of our technical abilities to measure nanoplastics. So it's hard to answer that question, but we might expect that there would be greater number of nanoplastics in the environment, but not as much mass. But it's hard to say, and there's a number of different methods that have been developed to try to analyze nanoplastic abundance. Some of them have challenges, but I just don't think there's enough data to really answer that question. Nanoplastics are certainly worse for human health because it can, move into our organs and cross the blood-brain barrier. We do have plastics accumulating in our brain and various parts of our body. In terms of the physical environment, again, I don't think there's been enough research to know whether or not the impact of nanoplastics is worse than microplastics. I would imagine certainly for other living organisms, nanoplastics would be more detrimental than microplastics.
What's your biggest fear as you go through this research that you might discover? Like, are you, right now you're focusing on the ice melt and the snow melt, and obviously that's a feedback loop that could... It's just one more feedback loop on all the feedback loops that we have with our climate. Is it human health that scares you the most? Is it the effects on climate or ecosystems as a whole? What are you worried about when it comes to microplastics?
Well, for all environmental things, it's human health that worries me the most. The Earth and life on Earth is fairly resilient. Not concerned in the long term about life on Earth, but I'm concerned about human life on Earth. We have not evolved and do not evolve fast enough to exist within the constraints that we're putting on our planet.
Well, you've just described perfectly the whole premise of my podcast, so thank you for doing that. Well, what's the best case scenario for you then? If we were to, stop all plastic production today, we still have, like you mentioned, all of the decades and decades of plastic production up to this point. Would it be looking for a way to remove existing plastics from the atmosphere? Would it be finding a way to coexist with those plastics? Like, what's the best case scenario?
Yeah, I think there's, a lot of people talk about working on technologies to remove plastics from different environments. I think the challenge is the scale. It's just they're not scalable to the scale of the problem, sure. Especially at the rate that we're producing plastic waste. I think, you know, the best case scenario was that globally, collectively, we would move towards eliminating single-use plastics altogether. And we would, you know, and there are people working on this. So this wouldn't be the area that I'm an expert in, but it's an area that I would love to get involved in. But there are, you know, people working with companies to create a single bottle that could be reused, and that same size bottle would be used by many, many different companies. So you wouldn't have each company producing their own specific shapes and styles and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. We would have one reusable bottle that could be recycled so that we could, you know, eliminate, you know, product-based single-use plastics. And that globally, collectively, we would have treaties about plastic production, producer responsibility, eliminating the waste trade. So, you know, one of the big challenges is that we, the Western countries, export all of their waste to other countries that don't have the infrastructure to handle the waste, that we would just stop doing that and be responsible for the own waste that we generate.
That would be a good first step for sure. Take responsibility for your own stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I interrupted. Any other thoughts there?
In terms of best case scenario, I think it's eliminating the problem at the source. But in terms of managing what we've already done, you know, that's tricky. I think, you know, in addition to preventing, eliminating single-use plastics and working on mechanisms to eliminate how plastic ends up in the environment, we would stop producing toxic products. You know, a lot of our utensils and, you know, things that we use in everyday life have a lot of additives that are really toxic, that we would just sort of eliminate these toxic products from our environment, because those are the things that are leading to problems with reproductive health and other physiological challenges.
We refer to it as the polycrisis. So there's a convergence of many, many different issues all kind of coming together at once that makes being alive as a human difficult. Thank you so much for your time today. It has been a pleasure to speak with you on this topic. I commend you for your work and for sticking with it for so long. And I hope that, you know, what you find out over these next coming years, that you find research that can help us find ways to mitigate the issues. And I hope that the funding and the resources necessary for you to continue to do your work are available. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.